From KALW San Francisco and PRX, this is Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller.
I used to be well. I had an infection. Now my life is falling apart. And everything that I once was and am is slipping away. And I need help. And I need you to help me. And I need you to listen to me. And I probably tried, you know, a dozen different strategies to convey that message. And it never worked. And I don't know why.
What happens when you know there's something terribly wrong, but no one believes you?
And so sometimes I would, you know, come in with like pages and pages of like meticulously documented symptoms and like charts, you know, detailing my heart rate and things like that. They would run a wide range of tests and do investigations. And then when they couldn't find anything, it always kind of then turned back to like, well, maybe you're just really stressed. Maybe you are depressed. Maybe there's nothing wrong at all. Maybe this is all in your head.
This is Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller. Not too long ago, if Jennifer Brea had gone to a doctor with her symptoms, she would have been diagnosed with hysteria, a catch-all for pretty much any unexplainable symptom experienced by a woman and attributed to things like an uncooperative uterus or sexual repression or sexual promiscuity or just women's frailty. It's not as blatant now, but not being taken seriously by medical professionals is a problem women contend with to this day.
One of the things that I never thought would happen to me is I started to suspect as I was trying to get a diagnosis that I was being taken less seriously because I was young and female. There was a strong expectation that because of my youth, I was supposed to be well and nothing could be wrong, but that also because of my youth and my gender, that I was just more prone to be kind of anxious and worry about my body and what I was feeling. And I think there's just this sort of unspoken expectation that women are more fragile, more achy, more whatever.
With each new symptom, Jennifer went to doctor after doctor, and none of them could figure out what the problem was. Until, out of desperation, she grabbed her iPhone and began to film herself.
And I, you know, it wasn't until I was seeing a new doctor and told him, you know, last night I got up and I had tried to walk across the room and I came back and I collapsed on the floor and I couldn't lift my head and, you know, why does that happen? And I saw him writing in his chart and not even really making eye contact with me. And so I took out my phone and said, no, look, like, this is what happened to me last night. And he just sort of turned white and said, you know, oh, my God, you need an MRI, you need a spinal tap. I don't know what is wrong, but something is clearly wrong with you. And I had this moment of thinking, wait, I've been telling you, not you, this one doctor, but all of these doctors for over a year, what happens when they're not there and I'm home alone. And nothing ever happened, but suddenly showing these videos, somehow that made it more real for them. Somehow suddenly it wasn't just, I don't know, me exaggerating or being, you know, overly concerned about my symptoms, but it was something real.
Today, Jennifer is diagnosed with a condition generically described as chronic fatigue syndrome, or myalgic encephalomyelitis, ME for short. Which is progress, I guess, but not really, because there is no test and there is no cure. She and millions of other people, mostly women, have quietly disappeared from the radar of the medical establishment while they suffer alone in their beds for days, weeks, months, sometimes unable to turn on a light or even listen to music because of their unbearable pain.
You know, I've often described this disease as a perfect custom prison because it, in some ways, doesn't matter what you once were. It takes that thing from you.
Medical schools and hospitals aren't really sure what to do with this. The National Institutes of Health, just by way of comparison here, spends $2,500 per person per year on AIDS and $250 per person per year on MS. Chronic fatigue syndrome gets $5 per person per year. To show the world that this is a real disease and not just in her head, with a truly debilitating impact on her life, and to inspire the medical community to take the lead on finding answers. Mostly from her bed, Jennifer created a film out of the videos she captured of herself, others like her, and the few experts there are. Her film is called Unrest.
So I got sick after a very high fever, and I thought that it was just the flu. And after the fever broke, I had that kind of rush you feel when a fever breaks and you're like, okay, it's over. I'm getting better. And then I got out of bed and tried walking to the bathroom, and I was so dizzy, I walked straight into the doorframe. And I think that was the first time I thought, okay, something's a little weird, because nothing like that had ever happened to me before. And then over the course of the next year, every time I got sick with like a sore throat or a cold or something relatively minor, I would end up what I would call now crashed, but like in bed for days, sometimes weeks. And I didn't know what was happening to me, but I knew very early on that something wasn't right. I just never thought that it would last as long as it has. And it really wasn't until, you know, a year into being sick, after going kind of down, when I became essentially permanently bedridden, with, you know, much deeper symptoms, sort of, you know, gastrointestinal symptoms, neurological symptoms. My whole body was in revolt. And I think that's when I knew, okay, what's happening to me now are things that I don't even have names for. I can't even describe. And I think that's when I knew that this wasn't going to be easy. And if I was going to get better, it wasn't going to happen right away. I had the sense that I was going to be living with this for a long time.
Could we go back to life, like pre-illness, and just, I would just love for you to describe like a typical day in the life. Who was Jennifer before all this went down?
Wow, it's really hard to remember. So I was a PhD student at Harvard. And so my typical day was just going to seminars, listening to talks, giving talks, teaching students, grading theses, running by the Charles River in Cambridge, going skiing in Vermont on the weekends with my family, and traveling. I loved to travel the world. So I was a freelance journalist for a while. I lived in China and traveled all around Africa and Asia, and also with my then boyfriend, then fiance, husband, Omar. We loved just exploring the world together.
So how would you describe yourself now, having lived with this illness for a number of years, and you're physically, you know, having been so affected, and possibly mentally as well?
So I think the mental part is the hardest part for me. You know, I've often described this disease as a perfect custom prison, because it, in some ways, doesn't matter what you once were, it takes that thing from you. So if you were an academic, as I was, it takes away your abilities to read and write and think in the same way. If you were a world champion athlete, it takes away those abilities. If you're a mother, you don't get to mother the way that you used to or might want to. And so I think for me, you know, I am absolutely the same person that I was before in so many ways. I'm still curious, and I still have that drive, and I still have all of the same ambitions. But now everything has to be sort of like filtered and narrowed through the constraints I have right now, through my disabilities and through my the limits I have to my energy, my ability to exert myself. And so I still feel like I'm the same person as I ever was. And, you know, you hear of people who, you know, are elderly, who, you know, have these bodies that, you know, are more frail and don't support them the way that they used to, but they, you know, in their minds are still, you know, young, right? Like, you never really feel like things have changed. And as much as this has changed and marked my body, I'm still constantly trying to still be myself and to still fully express my creativity and my dreams. And I think that throughout this whole process has been the hardest and most challenging part of reconciling having a chronic illness with the person that I once was and the person that I now am.
And were you just kind of trying to rationalize away the, you know, the sort of, I'm wondering if it's just this sense of incrementalism, like, you know, day one, you thought you were feeling better, but you weren't and you ran into the doorframe. Day two, you know, then something else happened and the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And then all these things start to add up to a much bigger picture, but each of them is an individual piece of the puzzle. And easy to say, oh, well, this time it was because dot, dot, dot. I mean, was that, did you have that feeling or like?
So that's actually really perceptive because I think that was a part of the reason why I had a hard time getting care from my doctor or being taken seriously, because every time I would go in, it was about one specific moment, one specific weird complaint that I had, you know, and my doctor is seeing, you know, hundreds of patients. So, you know, he doesn't really have a strong picture of his mind of like, oh, and then 2 months ago you came in about this. And then, you know, 4 months before that about this other thing. And it really wasn't until I sat down after the end of that first year and actually looked at my calendar and calculated that I'd actually been laying in bed 50% of the days of that year, that it fully dawned even on me just how deeply wrong things were. And I also think, you know, I did keep going and seeking medical care and seeking that expert advice. And when your doctor tells you, you know, your tests are normal, you're fine, and yet you're having these symptoms, it's sort of what, you know, what do you really have to go on? And so I started making up stories. Like I told myself, well, you know, this weekend I went skiing with my family, you know, was able to ski on that black diamond like the first day, although I kept feeling like my legs were about to give out constantly. And then I was laid up in the condo for, you know, the next 3 days. And I thought, okay, maybe I'm just getting older, right? Like maybe when you get to your late 20s, like this is what happens to your body. And so I had always thought that if something goes wrong and you need help, that expert, that doctor would be able to tell me, okay, this something is wrong and this is what you do about it.
Millions of people have this, right? The fact that it's not something that could immediately be at the top of a list of a doctor's potential diagnoses is, I don't know, that was sort of startling to me.
It was startling to me too. And the fact is that's what everyone has to do. So in my community, there are patients who have become really well-versed in the science and have become experts in their own disease, because it's not something where you go in and then someone says, you know, okay, here's what you have and here are your treatment options. And that's sort of, you know, what we imagine medicine is like and how it functions. The challenge is that this disease is not taught in most medical schools. And so doctors don't have the tools to diagnose patients early, when I think, you know, there is that option of treatment or at least management to prevent further disability. And so they're not getting diagnosed and they are left, you know, frequently to figure things out on their own. And it's exhausting and it's hard. Like women I spoke to who got sick in the 80s, where they would go in and people would say things like, oh, I really think you should just divorce your husband, then you'd feel better. Or they would tell the husband, if you leave your wife, then she'll have to get better. Or if you got a haircut, you would feel better. Or if you had kids, you would feel better. Or it's because you have kids that you don't feel well. I actually had a doctor who took my husband Omar outside the room and said, you know, you can leave her if you need to.
Oh my God. And he immediately told you.
Oh, he was so livid. He wanted to. Omar is like such a gentle guy. And it was the first time in my life I've ever thought he wanted to like just punch someone. I mean, I think it has gotten better in that the sexism is more subtle. And so it's harder to define and it's harder to know that it's happening. You just sort of feel like this kind of condescension that makes absolutely no sense. And so it's hard for me to even say, oh, that's sexist, because what you're saying to me is not as outrageous as, you know, get a haircut, get a divorce, paint your nails and things will be fine. But you still can't help but wonder, if I were older or a different gender, would you really be saying this to me right now? And so it's hard to put a finger on. And I think that makes it even harder to surface.
Have you ever asked a doctor that?
I wish I had. In the moment, I'm always, you know, maybe it's a little bit like trying to make the doctor, you know, kind of put on a face of everything's okay. But, you know, your doctor is your access to care. Your doctor can put something in a chart that will follow you for the rest of your life. Your doctor can make choices over whether to prescribe a drug that could make you feel much better or choose not to. And not that that power is wielded arbitrarily, but it's still power. And so I think when you have something like this and you're in a doctor's office, you want to present as the most reasonable person in the world. And you fear that if you're emotional, that's only going to affirm what they already think, which is that maybe you're just anxious, maybe you're depressed. And that's a horrible position to be put in, to have to, in some ways, not only be sick, not only to feel like crap, but then also to feel like you have to always present, you know, as like respectable. But that's something that I think a lot of, you know, like minority communities talk about, right? It's like you have to sort of that concern about like, do I speak out and do I lash out and do I say what I really think and feel, or am I supposed to try to convince you that I'm worthy of your good treatment?
And ever so slightly subservient somehow, right?
Well, you do feel like you're a supplicant. Yeah. I mean, and I think in our culture now, there are very few hierarchical relationships left. And this is one of them. And I do think that the doctor is an expert on the body of training they've received and the experience they amass from seeing, you know, hundreds and eventually thousands of patients. And at the same time, the patient is a different kind of expert on their own individual case, right? And you need kind of both expertise to be listened to in order for that relationship to work.
Is that a male doctor thing? I mean, have you found any difference between working with female doctors versus male doctors in that, with that description?
Oh, my female doctors have been awesome. It doesnn't always break down into gender terms. And the one thing I think is very important to say is that I've also known men who've been told it's all in their head. But I think that, you know, this is totally anecdotal, but almost every woman I've talked to has gotten a psychosomatic diagnosis at some point. Whereas for men, that's just less common. I had a female infectious disease doctor who was just incredibly thorough and tested me for everything that could possibly be remotely possible. It wasn't even plausible, just possible. And it was great because it helped to really rule out every other possible condition. And that was when was an important step toward getting this diagnosis. You know, and Nancy Klimas, who's in the film, is also really amazing. And I think I've had the fortune of working with a lot of really great doctors. And I do think somehow when I work with women doctors, I do have a sense that there's more of an assumption on the other side of credibility you're telling me the truth about what you're feeling. I've never felt in a consult room with a female doctor like I had to hide any of my symptoms.
So do you feel like you have a medical partner in all of this at this point? I mean, how are you managing your treatment right now?
I have a doctor who is an expert in LA and have been maintaining through access to antiviral drugs, which work for some people a little bit and for some people quite well, but which many people don't have access to. And these are drugs that were developed to help patients with HIV fight infections that we all have that are hard to control when your immune system gets compromised. So without these drugs, I would end up bedridden again, probably barely able to move within about 72 hours. So feel really fortunate that my insurance covers them. Not everyone's does. And I'm also taking a drug for an autoimmune disease called myasthenia gravis, and it helps with my muscle weakness and fatigability. So those were all prescribed by experts, and essentially we have, you know, maybe 10 experts around the country, maybe less. Many of them are retiring, and they all became interested in the disease, many of them in the 80s and 90s when chronic fatigue syndrome was very much in the news because there were a series of cluster outbreaks happening all over the country. So in some of cases, these are doctors who were infectious disease doctors or immunologists who suddenly noticed that all of these people were coming into their offices with similar symptoms. And so it's really just by kind of personal, by chance and kind of having been at the wrong or the right place at the right time that they sort of stumbled on this pattern, right? Because if you have one patient like me who comes in, you've never seen anything like this before, it seems rare and weird and idiosyncratic. But if you were in a town like in Klein Village, Nevada was, or as we think also happened in South Florida and a number of other places, and 10 or 20 or 30 or 50 people come in with the same symptoms, then you start to say, oh, wait, this looks like a thing because I can see a pattern here. And so there are a number of doctors, I think, who were in that situation or who had loved ones who got sick and were personally affected and got to see kind of with their own eyes the effects of the disease that are very hard to see.
I'm Lauren Schiller, and this is Inflection Point. I'm talking with Jennifer Brea, who became a filmmaker and activist after becoming bedridden with chronic fatigue syndrome.
What I gathered from watching the film is that one of your frustrations was you knew something was wrong, and you were not necessarily getting the satisfaction of other people acknowledging it, and that by making this film, you are shining a very bright light on what was very real, what is very real, and that not everyone could see. And so I was curious about when you decided to take your phone and start filming yourself in these really hard moments.
So my whole life, I had been a writer by constitution. I've written many first thirds of a book and never finished them, but I'd always been someone who had written to know what I thought and what I felt and had always kept a diary. And after my neurologist diagnosed me with conversion disorder, I decided to test out his hypothesis, thinking like, okay, well, if I had conversion disorder, wouldn't one of the symptoms maybe be that I didn't know that I had it or that I wouldn't accept that I had it? So maybe I should just try to like live with that hypothesis for a while and see what happens. And
conversion disorder, could you just explain what that is?
So conversion disorder is this idea that, you know, you have a trauma that you might not remember, that the doctor can't prove or even describe, but it's just sort of assume a trauma that no one knows about and no one can produce. And somehow this trauma years later, after an infection, is causing you to have symptoms that have no biological cause, but feel very real to you. So it's like your brain producing symptoms that aren't there for any biological reason, which I find befuddling because my brain is my body and it is biological. And so I don't fully understand how like this concept of mind, unless they're talking about like the immaterial spirit, which feels weird in the context of a doctor's office. I feel like medicine shouldn't be based on things that we can't see and don't exist, like a hidden memory that no one can produce. Regardless, I thought, okay, maybe this does happen sometimes and maybe something happened to me and I just can't remember it. And so I walked home that day about a mile to my house from the office, just kind of trying to notice the pain in my legs and sort of in some ways at the same time trying to think, okay, is somehow my mind creating this pain as I'm walking? Does that make sense? And so I walked home and then I collapsed on the floor. I had the last fever I've ever had and I was in bed the next 4 months. And so, you know, that is the cost of being wrong. And I've never walked that far ever again. And that's when I started to film myself, because it was just so hard to lose everything. And I didn't know what to do next. And I couldn't write anymore. Like, I would write a sentence of an email and then pass out for 4 hours. And so I had no way to cope with the experience. And I needed a place to put that pain and that fear and that grief. And so a friend of mine who is a writer said, you know, well, maybe you should just record your diary, you know, in audio, and then someday you'll go back and when you're better and you'll write about it. And my iPhone was what was close to me. So I took it out and just started filming myself. And I, you know, it wasn't until I was seeing a new doctor and told him, you know, last night I got up and I tried to walk across the room and I came back and I collapsed on the floor and I couldn't lift my head. And, you know, why does that happen? And I saw him writing in his chart and not even really making eye contact with me. And so I took out my phone and said, no, look, like, this is what happened to me last night. And he just sort of turned white and said, you know, oh my God, you need an MRI, you need a spinal tap. I don't know what is wrong, but something is clearly wrong with you. And I had this moment of thinking, wait, I've been telling you, not you, this one doctor, but all of these doctors for over a year, what happens when they're not there and I'm home alone and nothing ever happened, but suddenly showing these videos, somehow that made it more real for them. Somehow suddenly it wasn't just, I don't know, me exaggerating or being, you know, overly concerned about my symptoms, but it was something real. And that gave me this sense of like, okay, maybe this has to be told visually. And maybe you really can only believe what you can see with your own eyes.
So did you just start, without thinking about it, turning the camera on yourself all the time after that? Or were there certain moments where you were like, oh, this is a bad situation. Let me capture this one just so that it's documented? Or like, what was the sort of rhythm of starting to film yourself more and more?
I would film myself whenever I needed it, really. And sometimes it was just because I needed someone to talk to about those feelings of loss, you know, whether it was just feeling afraid that I would never be able to have kids, or feeling like I didn't know what purpose my life had anymore if I couldn't read or write or think and all I could do was lay in a bed, right? Like, my whole life I'd been preparing to do something, you know, and it, you know, was on track to become a professor and be someone who could do all of those things. And if my existence was just laying in a bed every day, day after day after day after day, I wondered why I was even still here. And so those were hard conversations to have with my husband, let alone my friends. And so I think the camera was just a way to talk about those things that I needed to process but couldn't quite confess. And so at that moment, I didn't intend to then share those moments with millions of people. But I just knew that it's what I needed to get through those times.
Did you feel like each time, did you know that you were going to get through each of those times? I mean, I'm imagining that laying in bed and not being able to do all the things you want to do can be really depressing. And I mean, you even say in the film at some point, and I'll paraphrase, but that, you know, not killing yourself was like success. Like, that was how low the bar was at one point for you.
I was never depressed, though. I mean, I think that, you know, depression often follows chronic illness. And I don't know why I didn't get depressed. I'm really glad that I didn't have to deal with depression on top of everything else. I always had the motivation and the drive and the desire to keep going and to do as much as I could every day, whether I had, you know, 10 minutes or 10 hours. It was more just a kind of rational understanding of the fact that every day I was in bed, waking up every morning, looking at the same ceiling, disappointed that I was alive. And, you know, we know what that kind of isolation does to people. Like many patients who are very severe liken it to living in solitary confinement. And it's just, I mean, it's crazy making to wake up every morning in the same place and not be able to do anything. And so I just, you know, and I was getting worse and worse and worse. Like my function was going down, 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 down. I got into a point where I could only eat 3 foods. I was having just like massive reactions and everything was making my joints swell and it was just as horrible. And so I was facing the fact that like I probably at some point was going to lose the ability to eat. And I was also facing the fact that, you know, it was just getting harder and harder to get to the bathroom. And so I didn't know how long I would have, but I think that every day just was sort of kind of ruminating on the possibility that this was going to end in death, that it was going to end in self-euthanasia. Because you have to understand, I'm living in a community where, you know, I'm connected to a lot of other patients online. And over the last several years, you just lose people. Like we've lost a lot of people and I've lost people that I've known. And so it's not abstract anymore when you see other people choose to exit the pain. And when you're in that much pain every day, yeah, I thought that I might be forced to do that as the only solution to that much unbelievable pain.
So what was the turning point for you?
The turning point for me was seeing a doctor in New York who prescribed me a drug called Valsite, which is an antiviral drug. And he said, you know, no, your tests don't imply that you should have this drug but sometimes your immune system doesn't even see the virus. And, you know, just try it and see how you feel. And within a matter of a few days, I got up one morning and started walking, and then I just kept walking. And it wasn't very far, and I still can't walk very far, but all of a sudden I had this increased capacity that was undeniable. And the thing that's really scary about being on the severe part of the spectrum is that even though it's possible to come back from that, the worse you get, the harder it is. It's sort of like, you know, health begets health. And it was with that drug that I started to have enough health to be able to like leave the house more and go and see other doctors and try other things. Like that was kind of my like anchor or my sort of beachhead in a way. And then since then, I've just kept adding small things, big things, adding 5%, 10% here and there so that I'm able to function more. And, you know, I still have a hard time with my physical stamina, but I am able to have the cognitive stamina to, you know, work 10 hours a day and do a lot of the things that I love.
So where in all of this did it occur to you that you could start filming other people? And then once you did that, that this could become a film that other people could see and learn from your experiences?
So I decided that I wanted to make a documentary of the personal footage. Essentially, when I went online and started to just meet more and more patients who had been sick for, you know, 10, 20, 30 years and started to understand just how big this issue was, how longstanding it was, how many people had, you know, fought really hard for recognition and for equality and had, you know, essentially been sidelined. And I think I felt like, I came to the realization that things were not going to change without something to sort of shake them up. And I thought, okay, I don't know if I can contribute to that, but I have to at least try because I couldn't imagine having, you know, a conversation with a younger version of myself in 20 or 30 years that was like, yeah, it was really bad back in, you know, in 2015. And so that's when I decided to make a film. And I think it was at that point that I started to say, okay, I should do a Kickstarter campaign because you have to understand I wasn't a filmmaker. I didn't know any other filmmakers and had no idea how I was going to get the funding or put the crews together. I didn't even understand like how to go about doing that. But I had seen other people do you know, Kickstarter campaigns for their creative projects. So I started shooting for the campaign, and I would go to New York and shoot kind of one day a month. And it would take me 29 days to recover from the effort. So it was sort of 6 months. I shot 6 days and did this campaign, and we ended up meeting our goal in less than 48 hours and raising over $200,000. And it, you know, I started telling a story in part because when I got sick, you know, I'm someone who had always looked to novels and films and stories as a way to explain my experience to myself. And suddenly I was going through the most profound change, for lack of a better word, in my life. And I had no story to hold on to in a way, because it was like, you know, like the narrative wasn't there. I had never known that this could happen to someone, and I had never been prepared for it. Like, in some ways I had been prepared, you know, probably badly, but by TV, you know, and cinema, to like get cancer someday maybe, or get Alzheimer's someday maybe, or to care for someone who had that and at least have a conception of what that was like. But here I was with a disease that had no clear concept, or the only concept out there was very much the wrong one. And so I think the campaign showed me that there were a lot of people who felt the same way I did. I mean, it went viral essentially. And it was really that support from the community that helped me to see that, oh, okay, like there is a bigger potential here. And now I have the money, because like filmmaking takes money to actually shoot around the world and tell a story that can travel and hopefully help, you know, people not just in the US, but in Europe and elsewhere. And so I started to, you know, reach out to people on social media about participating in the film. And I think for me, that was really, you asked about what changed. I think for me, you know, getting better has helped, certainly having more physical capacity, but connecting with other patients has been such an important part of this, because I was able to suddenly, in the process of telling other people's stories, start to see, okay, this is what this moment that feels so impossible to survive might look like 10 years out or 20 years out. And these stories are all really hard. People still struggle, but some find ways to still get married and have families and do work and contribute in ways that are meaningful, even within these very, very narrow confines. And so in that moment when I thought that I might end up taking my own life, I think it was those stories of people like Jessica, this young woman in my film who has been bedridden since she was 14, you know, but runs a charity from her bed to help other kids who are also dealing with chronic illness and or terminal illness. It gave me this hope that even though I didn't know how I was going to survive it, that I could, that it was possible, that somehow I would find my way and find something on the other side.
One of your diagnoses was conversion disorder, and its great aunt or grandmother is hysteria. And I use a gendered grandparent on purpose, because this is something that women were primarily diagnosed with. So as you started to dig into the history of these early diagnoses of what was potentially what you have now, diagnosis ME, what did you learn about that, and how did that help you understand the way that you were being responded to as you tried to discover what was going on?
So it's a fascinating history, and I'm by no means an expert on it, but it extends even farther back before Freud's conception of hysteria. And sort of in medicine, we've always had a wastebasket for things that we couldn't explain, always. So in sort of medieval medicine, there was this idea of natural and unnatural illness. So natural illnesses you could treat with herbs, right? So sort of, you know, what would be drugs nowadays, but they were amenable to treatments that were essentially biological. But there's always been this idea of unnatural illnesses. So illnesses that were caused by possession or spirits. And those illnesses tended to be things that affected the behavior of the patients and essentially scared people. So, you know, epilepsy was an unnatural illness. Certain mental illnesses were natural, and so certain mental illnesses were unnatural illnesses. And so you sort of see that kind of bifurcation very early on, you know, before modern psychology. And then we had kind of have this history, you know, stretching back and then up until the present day, of as science is able to measure more and objectively describe more, we pull different diseases out of that basket. So epilepsy was pulled out of that basket of, you know, unnatural or hysterical by the invention of the EEG machine that could then measure the epileptiform, you know, kind of spikes of activity happening in a patient's brain. Or MS was taken out of that wastebasket by the development of the MRI. And even, you know, like into the 50s and 60s, there was still a debate about, you know, hysterical MS versus non-hysterical MS. And even tuberculosis, there, you know, we've known since the 1890s that it was caused by a bacterium, but it wasn't until the development of really effective antibiotics that, you know, doctors stopped publishing pieces about psychosomatic tuberculosis in medical journals. So I think we've always had sort of medicine, and I think probably all of us have always had challenges grappling with the unknown. And in some ways, there's this instinct to try to define and to judge, as opposed to understanding that, well, there are some things that we really can't define yet because we don't yet have a science, but that's a limitation of our own understanding. It has nothing to do with the intrinsic nature of the disease.
Thinking about the hysteria, though, because that term actually came from a problem with a woman's reproductive organs causing mental distress, basically, right? So, and my understanding is that with many autoimmune diseases, that women do get affected more than men. And women are also credited with having the sort of higher tolerance for pain and accused of being overdramatic and exaggerating their symptoms. I mean, you do have a doctor in the film that talks about, you know, she says at one point, I'm just going to be a feminist for a minute here. And then she talks about the female history of this disease. So I'm just curious. I mean, this is a show about women. So what your impressions are of how that plays into the way that people responded to you, or the way that you've seen other people responded to by virtue of the fact that it is primarily affecting women.
One of the things that I never thought would happen to me is I started to suspect, as I was trying to get a diagnosis, that I was being taken less seriously because I was young and female. There was a strong expectation that because of my youth, I was supposed to be well and nothing could be wrong, but that also because of my youth and my gender, that I was just more prone to be kind of anxious and worry about my body and what I was feeling. And I think there's just this sort of unspoken expectation that women are more fragile, more achy, more whatever. And so I started bringing my Omar, who is then my fiance, into my appointments with me with this hope that, like, well, maybe if there's like this, you know, third party male certification in the room that can say, like, yes, I was there and I observed her, this happened to her, that I would be taken more seriously or at least treated better. And it definitely improved things to have him in the room. It may not have changed what anyone was thinking, but they were at least a little bit more careful about how they expressed it. And, you know, I've talked to and interviewed countless women who have been told that, you know, whether they're grappling with ME/CFS, chronic fatigue syndrome, or, you know, autoimmune conditions, or I even had a friend who had a brain tumor that was misdiagnosed as anxiety for years before they finally ran the right brain imaging to be able to see it. And, you know, I think that women's testimony of their own bodies are just not taken seriously. And I don't entirely know why. I think there are these deep inheritances in our culture that we don't even know where they come from. But I do remember when I was starting to read more about Freud and the concept of hysteria, how it was almost verbatim what my doctor told me in the office when he diagnosed me, and how he probably didn't even know where those ideas and where that kind of piece of his training came from.
What are your hopes for this film?
So I hope that we can bring it to many medical schools and academic scientific departments and put it in front of policymakers and really use it as a catalyst to grow the movement for equal access to research and treatment. And I would hope that this helps people to kind of connect the dots a bit better and to decide to support us and join us in this movement for equality. Because I frame it as a social justice issue. I frame it as a gender equality issue. And so I think it's something we all need to pay attention to, because it is a sign, I think, of some of the things that are still deeply wrong about our medical culture and the way that we treat patients in general.
What's the best advice that you've ever been given about getting someone to take you seriously?
I don't think it's your job to get someone to take you seriously. I think you tell the truth and you live your life, and that if someone doesn't take you seriously or won't believe you, that person's not your friend and they're not your doctor. You know, I mean, I get so many messages from people that are like, you know, my parents don't believe me. What do I say to them? What do I do? And I guess you really can't get new parents, can you? I think it's important to own what is true for you and to understand that sometimes there are people in your life that aren't going to understand, and that that's really painful and that's really hard, but that there are also literally thousands of people out there who you don't know yet, but we're here and we will embrace you and we will do everything we can to support you and we will believe you. So I do think that there is community and connection out there, even if that's not something that's easy to find, you know, in your own home or in your own community.
Oh, Jennifer, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Confession. When I watched the screener for Unrest, I had to stop and start it a couple of times. Jennifer Brea puts everything into it, and it's uncomfortable to see her in the pain that she's in. But Jennifer couldn't stop and start her life. After talking with Jennifer, I had three reactions. Maybe you did as well. One, a little bit of terror. Here's one more awful thing that could happen to me or my daughters or my husband or friends. Two, trying to convince people in power to take this illness seriously is a huge burden for people who are already weakened by the very nature of their disease. My third reaction was, if it hadn't happened to Jennifer, whose sharp intellect and curiosity led her to research her own disease, and if she hadn't found the strength to make this film, I probably wouldn't have paid it much attention, unless it had personally affected me or someone I know. But Jennifer's experience is real, and it does need to be taken seriously. It shouldn't just be up to the people affected by it to speak out or find a solution. So, hey, if you're a scientist and you can solve this, there are millions counting on you. When women rise up, they find the voice to say, "This is real. This is happening. I may not know why this is happening, but let's find out. And then let's find out what to do about it." This is Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller. That's our Inflection Point for today. Know a woman with a great rising up story? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. While you're there, I invite you to become a patron of Inflection Point. Inflection Point is brought to you in partnership with KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco and PRX. You can find our podcast on iTunes, Radio Public, and NPR One. Give us a 5-star review. We'd love that. Our story editor and content manager is Alora Weaver. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. And I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.